Yes. Now we are.
Their main characters tend to have the same sexuality they do. Or at least I've noticed this is for... I've noticed this for male gay writers in
well,
the fandom. Is it almost always? Well, I don't want to say almost always, but a lot of the time, their main character is also a gay male. And I always forget their sexuality until they like notice like, oh, those two guys kissing over there.
The same way in which some people don't necessarily want to write a coming out story. I don't really want to have to go through every story going, oh, this character is not in fact gay.
Well,
and so therefore I'm not going to write about it.
I never see a point for most stories to show that they're gay or need a reason for them to be gay, but it shows up.
You're talking in a non-erotic story.
In non-erotic
stories,
yes.
Because as somebody who is, you know,
in erotic
gay,
stories, they're going to tend to write the sexuality
as someone who is
better. So
as someone who is gay or bi, the likeliness of it is that they would like to be in a world where it is safe to assume that somebody could be gay or is gay. And so I think that's probably why it comes up a lot.
I understand your point.
I'm fine with that. Like, I'm all
I understand Ocean's point, too.
But like, if it plays no part in the story whatsoever, same thing with the person's religion or personal preference to peanut butter or coffee. It's
think of it like flavor text.
Like
at
the same
shit.
Time, if you asked me if my characters were straight or gay, I'd probably be like, oh, well, they're straight. But I never really thought about that unless I'm putting them in a romantic situation.
I think the unfortunate default is that, you know, a character is straight unless proven otherwise.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to mention it if it's not that. Like, if a character is going to be gay,
I understand
you
that.
Almost have to make a point of mentioning it, or else everyone's just going to assume otherwise.
But at the same time, you don't. If it has no bearing on the story, then you don't actually have to. Like, wasn't there a Harry Potter character that at the end they were like, yeah, he's gay?
Yeah.
It's almost.
And that she didn't never change actually... anything, exactly.
Was it Dumbledore?
Dumbledore was gay.
That is almost
the point. I thought there was a lesbian too.
But Dumbledore, the whole thing with Dumbledore didn't come out until after the books were done.
Yeah.
And then she was like, oh yeah, I always kind of pictured Dumbledore being gay. And people were like, what? Yeah.
See, and suddenly it was a huge revelation, but it didn't change a thing.
Right, but...
except for the amount of...
The example that you used is the fact that, you know, Dumbledore was this character throughout the entire book. And yeah, it didn't need to be expressly mentioned. But it doesn't come up at all in any of the books for any reason. And then they're like, oh, he's gay. Well, yes, there's no point in saying that. You can say anything now that the book's done. You know, millions of people have already bought your copy.
Yeah.
But
it's already
almost,
made you a mint.
It's almost like a silent stand. You know, if you're writing a book that mentions that a character's gay, but has nothing to do with the plot. The same way that a character being straight doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the plot.
No. And I understand the norm is still people are straight.
And even so, if this is the first
I think somebody who's writing about a gay character feels obligated to mention because it wouldn't be assumed otherwise.
I don't know, for me, when I write my characters, I never really... Like, maybe this is why I have horrible characters, is that I don't put that much detail into their lives. Like, what's their religion? I don't know. Does it matter? Or, you know, are they straight or gay? I'm like, ugh.
And I understand your point, but I'm trying to explain what might lead to something like that.
Oh, yeah, no, I
because
agree
it,
with that.
I think it's unfair to be like, oh, this person says they're gay, but it has nothing to do with the story.
I'm not putting it down. It's just an observation I keep noticing.
Well, here's the other side of it. Maybe we're so okay with the concept of bi and gay characters that we don't feel it needs to be input for a character because they're a human being and it doesn't play any factor at all in the story. So
yes, which is sort of why I said it's sort of like a silent activist statement, because you're almost doing it with the intent of being like, this character's gay.
But you don't even have to sit there and like
just kind of unconscious.
It doesn't even
almost.
Have to be like a statement at the beginning that he's such and such and he's a gay character. It can be that he sees, you know, a guy that he finds attractive. Even if that's the only mention of it in the story, that's great. But to actually include it in the description of his character in the opening to the story, it's not necessary. It's something that can come.
I found a lot of stories. It's not necessarily the beginning. It's just like when I read a book and I'm just in the mindset because, you know, I'm straight. I just, you know, you start to assume everyone's straight.
Yeah.
It's not a something you're proud of or anything. It's just that's what happens, right?
Well, this,
when you're in a community, you just assume everyone else is like you, which is dumb.
This reminds me of a conversation that I've
had. Let me finish.
Sorry.
So when you're reading the book, you're just under the assumptions that like okay, so I'm a straight male, you know, Christian. So I assume like, oh, this person right there probably, when I'm reading a character, when I'm picturing in my mind, that's generally the first thing that comes to my face. So that when I'm reading it and I get halfway through and eventually the guy goes, oh, look at that. Oh, hey, maybe I should date that guy over there. I'm just like, oh, right. He could be gay. I never thought about that. And then it just kind of like snaps me out for a second. I go, huh, so he's gay. And then jump back in.
The point that I think I understand that you're getting at, which is similar to conversations I've had with Tal, are where Tal will say, you know, hi, I am Tal. Like, being gay does not define me.
Yeah.
Like, that kind of thing. Like, if you approach somebody and go, hey, I'm gay. Yes, that's a very awkward thing to do. The same amount of awkwardness that it would take for you to walk up to somebody and be like, hey, I'm Ryan. I'm straight.
Yeah.
Like, now, it doesn't need mentioning.
Now, on the other hand, where I've been arguing against you don't need to say it, one case where you do need to say it is I've read stories where it's you've gone through 2/3 of the story, and it's then you find out the main character is, say, black. And it's like,
oh.
Did you see the controversy with the Hunger Games?
Yes.
What happened?
People didn't know that the little black girl that dies was black.
Oh.
And they were pissed.
Oh, because in the movie they actually have her as black?
In the movie they actually cast her as a black girl, which she is in the book.
Is that kind of the same for when they did the Thor movie? And usually the Guardian guy is actually white, but in this one they're like, we'll make him black. And everyone's just like, he can't be black. And they're like, just cool your jets.
That guy was pretty cool.
Yeah, no, that guy did an amazing job.
But yeah, and the thing is it's just like, but in a story like that, I mean, maybe it's a bit, I don't know if this is racist or not, but it changes my perception of how the story is going.
I don't think it's racist. I think it's just because the society you live in and who you are, it's just set up in your mind that's the default state.
Well, it's like Japanese horror. I'll go to you. It's like Japanese horror. You read a Japanese horror story, you're reading it from the context of a Western Caucasian, and there's things in there that you don't get horror-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Because you didn't grow up in Japan.
Yeah, you don't know the culture.
The concept that there is a girl who's been rotting in a water well and you've been drinking her body fluids for weeks. To us, ew, that's it. To the Japanese, this is horrific. This is you have done something next to cannibalism. You are, you've dirtied your spirit. You've, mm-hmm. you know, you've gone against your ancestors. You've done all these horrific things. Whereas in the Western culture, it's like, okay, that's really gross.
Ew.
You know, let me sue whoever did this.
Oh, let's get some clean water and a Brita filter.
Yeah. Well, it's like transplants. The Japanese have a huge thing against transplants from dead bodies. Mm. And it's horrific. They have this dead person's organ in them, where for us, in Western society, it doesn't matter.
We're like, that's a fabulous thing we're able to do.
Yeah. Okay.
But yeah, your point on the whole race thing is that, yeah, like, stereotypes do exist for a reason, although people don't like to admit it. But what I was thinking about with the gay thing, it's almost like how you would describe an attribute to a character.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just go, I'm gonna look in the mirror, I have blue eyes, brown hair, you know,
and a gay looking
facial
face.
Features. And oh yeah, by the way, I'm gay. Etc. Like typical
flamboyant,
typical
pink
movie,
shirt, like short shorts. No,
and a hole in my crotch.
Backup dancer for Michael Jackson or like, Lady Gaga.
Time to strap on my roller skates and go see the guys.
I think part of that has to do with the fact that people get stuck into doing like the movie montage kind of,
or the very
monologue.
Stereotypical gay. Which
like
we're
think about
done with.
Like one of the first things I think about when like somebody does that. Hi, I'm blank. I live in blank. I do blank. I think of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Where you've got, you know, Tobey Maguire, Peter Parker going, this is my life story. Okay, and now we're actually going to watch my life story.
Yeah.
Which, executed well, is fine.
Well, not really those movies,
but kind of introduces that same kind of thing. You're like, hi, I'm Toby. Yeah. I'm gay. As much as this is Toby's beginning to sound like a name. Toby is a good gay name.
It is. Come on, you don't laugh, but you gotta admit it totally is.
Oh, I'm totally chuckling inside.
Welcome to another episode of Fangs and Fonts. I am Voice.
I'm Ocean.
I'm Roland.
I'm Yanara.
And today we are going to talk about the naughty people in novels. Naughty novels.
Naughty.
Specifically antagonists, naughty people. Not that type of naughty.
Yeah.
Naughty people could be antagonists.
Depends on what you're writing.
Mostly porn.
Unfortunately, that seems to be it, isn't it?
So, antagonists. What is an antagonist? I, our awesome Wikipedia spider, have pulled the following description. An antagonist is a character, group of characters, or institution that represents the opposition against which the protagonist or protagonists must contend with. In other words, an antagonist is a person or group of people who oppose the main characters.
To which I quickly debated that it's not necessarily a person.
No.
And there's plenty of stories out there.
To which I had to ask, does a story need an antagonist? Or does it just need the conflict?
Then for my definition, antagonist is not necessarily a bad guy, but to me an antagonist is the thing preventing the protagonist from overcoming their conflict, or perhaps
producing the conflict. It is specifically the obstacle that the protagonist is trying to overcome.
Well, like the example I put was, in the perfect storm, there's no bad guy, it's just the storm.
That said, it's also the thing that the protagonist is going up against that can end up defining the protagonist's character. It's the anvil to which the protagonist is beat upon to become a better character and to go through his character growth.
Yeah, which is why I say it's not a person, but it's basically a noun. Because there are times where the antagonist is like an ideal.
See, yeah. I suppose I never really thought about it as much more than like a single person or people, like a group of people.
Well, even
and even the leader of like a group of people is the one antagonist who is directly opposing the protag.
Well, go one step past that. Say you're doing a coming out story, and so the character is gay and coming out. And although there's probably a group of people that terrorize them, and you would say that is the antagonist, the real antagonist of the story is society's views on how, you know, people can't be straight, that gay is not a sufficient lifestyle. It's really that ideal. And those people are just minions to that ideal.
And that's one of the things that will come into later, is your primary antagonist does not...
ideal or ID?
Ideal.
Oh, jeez.
Your primary antagonist isn't necessarily your villain. They can be two completely separate things, much as Ocean just pointed out. Now, what makes a good antagonist? I know we all covered our favorite literary antagonists and why.
Well then, what is your favorite literary antagonist? Or what's the best one that comes to your mind right now? Let's just start with that.
Moriarty is pretty badass. That was yours, wasn't it?
That was mine. Okay. It's okay.
I could choose another one.
Go ahead. Go ahead. I let you go.
Well, I don't actually know much about Moriarty outside of what I've actually watched in the newer movies. But, I mean, the fact that you have, like, his... The thing about Sherlock Holmes is that he is, like, one of the most unbeatable people in the entire world. Like, there's no match for him. And then you all of a sudden have this person that comes up. But as far as he's portrayed in the movie... Shut up.
Irene Adler, sorry.
Okay, but she is still like they're mostly on par. The only person that even threatens to like sort of overtake Sherlock is Moriarty. He is the true mastermind who gets the lead on Irene and Sherlock and seems to be like the only opposing threat to Sherlock's well-being, because, you know, Irene obviously doesn't want to get rid of Sherlock. She just wants to kind of fuck with him a little. I wouldn't. I'm not sure I would call her the antagonist of that story.
Well, what would you call the antagonist of most Sherlock Holmes stories?
His own ego.
In using your definition, the case, whatever he's trying to beat at the time. So be it the murder, but, you know, and then obviously as the stories go on, Moriarty becomes the antagonist.
You know, an interesting fact about Moriarty? What? He was only in 2 Sherlock Holmes stories.
I read that this morning.
Which is funny because
and yet he's one of the most famous bad guys.
Yeah, he is such an impactful character on...
I think that goes back to when I was talking about Moriarty as being one of my favorites, is because we have Sherlock Holmes and he just builds up that this guy just apparently can do anything, deduce anything, so that when we finally have an enemy that can match him, we already see a huge power level. I feel disgusted for saying that, but...
Over 1,000!
Thank you. But yeah, we have this bar set so high. When we finally have something to meet it, we don't need to fill in the gaps of how powerful this guy is because we already know.
Yeah, you see this person who is just godly to the normal person, and then you're like, who the hell's going to beat this person? And then when he comes, you're like, oh my god. Like, you don't even think about it, really.
Let me see. Since you've taken my one from last time, I'll bring up another one that I really liked. If you've ever read The Incarnations of Immortality... The first 5 books, I believe, all have the common enemy of Satan.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because each book you're seeing normal human beings being put in these superhuman, beyond reality roles. And as they're struggling to understand what their duties are, what their abilities are now, and what they're supposed to do, they've got Satan, who just seems to know everything.
He's dogging them every step because it's all hat to him. And he's just fucking with the news.
He's screwing them over every step of the way, mind games and everything. And they're left trying to do whatever they can, learn whatever little edge they can to get slightly ahead. And it's interesting when they interact with the other incarnations, because the other incarnations are like, oh man, you're new. You're screwed. Good luck, dude. We'll see you in like 10 years when you figure it out.
Yeah.
And then what's great is that you've seen him through all those books, that when it comes to, I want to say book 6, but I think it was actually book 5, it's actually Satan's book. And you're like, you get to see the other side of the story. And it's fantastic because you've built up this character that you think, like, ah, oh, this is Satan. He's evil and all this horrible stuff. And you actually see his side of the story. It's complete 180 in its turnaround. It's fantastic.
Nimoy. Because
Captain Nimoy.
2,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
I never considered him an antagonist.
He is to the main character, but the thing is he's a relatable antagonist.
Even then, I don't find him, he's antagonizing the main character, because he's like, look, you're an oceanographer. I am giving you the trip of a lifetime.
Yes, but...
I'm a bad guy.
Yeah.
Like to Ned. Ned hates...
Yeah.
Hates Nemo, but meanwhile, the Nimoy. Professor... Nimoy?
Nimoy?
Nimoy is, oh, is Leonard.
Yeah, sorry. I was thinking freaking fish. Mark.
No.
Sorry.
That's it. but
he's still the thing that's defining and going up against the protagonist, because he's still captured him. He's still got him in prison. But at the same point, he is like, hey.
You're free to do whatever you want, except between these one times when I tell you not.
Yeah, exactly.
But even throughout the book, the character's like, Ned wants to escape. I don't know if I want to.
But that's the thing, is that's why Nimoy is a very well-done antagonist, is because he's relatable, and you're like, he's not, you know, he starts off being this terrible person. You know, the imprisonment, all the killings of ships. He's doing all these things that you're like, oh my god, he's evil. But then as he continues on, it's like, wait, no, he's really not. He's just got his own ideals that he's fighting for, and he's actually a fairly noble man.
He's just
man.
Pissed at the world.
Yeah. No one would let me have my giant submarine, so I made it myself.
No, it was more than that.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Yeah, it's interesting, because I never really considered him an antagonist. Like, he's a little bit at the beginning, but as it comes on...
But that's the thing, is he's an evolution.
I guess he kind of is the antagonist. It's weird.
I know. But it's a good case of a well-done antagonist.
What's the cheetah got?
Galliorep is probably my favorite antagonist, because he is used in all the books up until the midway point. Actually, she just released the last book, too. this week. I'm behind in the reading, and I'm stoked to see how she ends the Rachel Morgan series.
I'll be buying you all the books for the Kobo.
But basically, for every book, Elgalia Repet is the demon. He's the bad guy. He's the thing that everyone hides from. He's the thing that's tricking everybody. He's the one that's snatching up bodies and snatching up souls and snatching up people who can cast circles and hold magic, and he's the one who's selling humans and witches as familiars to other demons. But then you start getting more into Al's character, and poor bastard's just immortal, bored, and likes his comfort. I mean, if you're so long-lived, I mean, basically his magic, every time he does a certain type of transformation magic, he resets his biological clock back to zero. So he's lived a really, really, really freaking long time. And he just wants to be comfortable. He just wants to live his life. And he's kind of deteriorated to the point where his moral compass is kind of spinning in a few circles. It doesn't really point anywhere anymore. If he has to do A to get B, well, you know, pull up your knickers. You're on the market tomorrow. So I guess I like Al just for that reason alone. He's always portrayed as such a bad guy, you know, snatching people and trying to trick people into, you know, basically servitude, and a horrible one at that. But I still like him as a character because it's not that just he's evil. You're cattle. He's lived so many hundreds of years that you are literally the blink of an eye. He'll forget about you in a century. So, you know, do you feel bad for the chicken that lays your eggs? Why would Al feel bad for you for tossing you in as a familiar?
It's kind of like Dracula.
Kinda. But I mean, you have to figure that a lot of antagonists come about just because the moral compass isn't pointing in one direction anymore, and that usually follows along the line of a long-lived character.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, elves are a really piss-poor example because they're like the fucking hippies of the fantasy world. Dude, love everyone. But on the same coin, I mean, if I were really long-lived, I would have zero morals. Like, just done. I would have done everything and anything and just went, okay, I did that, what next?
So, we've all kind of touched on it, but what makes a good antagonist? When you're reading a story, what kinds of antagonistic traits pull you in?
Assholes.
What do all four have in common?
They're all jerks.
Oh, Nemo wasn't really an asshole.
I guess all four of them have one thing in common, is they have their own goals.
Nemo was to the British.
They're not just evil for being the sake of being evil. They've all got goals that are centric to what they want.
They all can bend the rules to what they want.
That's rules don't just exist if you don't acknowledge them.
Rules are just there to make the impotents follow others' rules.
They all oppose the main character. You can't see me, you know.
Again, I still don't think Nemo was really that opposing. Again, he didn't have to take them on the ship. He, you know.
There's a lot that we didn't have.
There's, yeah.
Well, what do you think they all have in common then?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
Oh.
Discussion.
Well, they
you
all
know.
Oppose the main character. Longer story short.
Most of them all seem to be brilliant.
True.
Can we think of any stupid antagonists?
Oh, probably.
Yes.
Yeah, no, never mind.
The thing, okay, the one thing that they all do is
we
they
just
all,
like the crafty ones.
Yeah. I'm going to go with Roland's thing here, and they do all challenge the protagonist. But therein lies the thing. They are all these characters who are above and beyond the means of the protagonist in each story, and even in Nemo, because he has the sub and he has all the things where the guy is just the simple oceanographer. So they are this huge force that the protagonist is setting himself against one way or another, and thus is being something that the protagonist can challenge themselves against, which is one of the case. If you have a weak antagonist, your protagonist will end up seeming that much more weaker because he's going up against something that really is no challenge to him. That's why Mary Sue characters are so much more boring, is because you can't set up a proper antagonist against them, because if they're already an overpowered whatever, what are you going to have against them that makes it any good?
That was the point I was going to get at, pretty much, is that, you know, the antagonists, you know, much like Ocean was describing with the storm being the antagonist, the antagonists are the hurdle that these main characters are trying to get past. And what makes a character interesting, what makes a story interesting, and what, you know, invokes interest in your reader is that these people are difficult to overcome. They present a challenge, and their means start well above and beyond the means of the main character. Such as, you know, when you start out with a character like Moriarty, he's got such an advantage over a character like Sherlock until Sherlock can catch up.
Well, it's like Lex Luthor over Superman. It's like, how do you beat a character such as Superman? Well, you have Lex Luthor. And having a normal person go up against Lex Luthor would be a case of, yeah, there's no way in heck a normal average Joe could do it.
Or Batman and every other DC character.
Well, that was actually, there was actually, in No Man's Land, there is an interesting scene in there where it's Lex Luthor's got this tent set up with his bionics bodyguard. And in the middle of the night, Batman ends up getting face to face with Lex Luthor in his bed. Like, wakes him up, and Lex Luthor's like, you know, just calmly looks around and is like, you've disabled my bodyguard. What do you want? But he's like, still kind of like, how the F did Batman get in through all my security guards?
Oh and my God, like, I'm sleeping right next to Batman.
So hard right now.
I didn't realize Lex Luthor was gay.
It's the bald head.
It's the classy dressing.
You ever seen him with a woman?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't.
Yeah, I have.
I don't know much
Wasn't
about
it just Paul. A PR stunt?
Almost all his bodyguards are women.
But we've seen Batman or Bruce Wayne with a bunch of women.
And
but he spends all his time with little boys.
Yeah, and a bunch of little boys.
Batman teaching little boys parkour.
I'll catch you. Rule number one, don't trust anyone.
Actually, that brings me up to an interesting thing. Look at Batman's antagonists. They're, compared to Batman, they're darker and more crazy than Batman.
And they have zero moral compass.
Yeah. Well, the best ones are just...
Yeah. No, we've been using a lot of these examples to describe the relationship between good people
and
bad people.
Well, look at Mr.
Don't forget that the opposite's true.
Mr. Freeze is a good antagonist.
That's
because,
what I was getting around to. He's he's not he doesn't.
He's not a bad guy.
Well, he is, but at the same time, he had a bit of a moral. He didn't...
He had one goal, and the only reason he turned into a bad guy is because everyone kept getting in front of his goal.
And that's also his weakness.
That's very true. I'm going to unplug your wife. No! God, it's like...
Don't do anything. Just leave Nora alone. Just leave. I will do any... Just leave Nora alone.
Yeah.
Is usually how
every single encounter ends.
Exactly. Meanwhile, there's Joker who's like, I have nothing to lose.
Here, have my right-hand henchman. I sewed a bomb into his tummy. Enjoy!
Well, even Joker's like, I'm fine if I die, if you die too.
Yeah.
You know, even if I die and your grief is on your head, I still win.
I still win because I'm still in your head.
And that's why Joker tends to be a much more interesting villain than Freeze.
Because
Freeze is much more simplistic. He has a weakness. He's got his basic, like, he's, okay, so he freezes people and then he's got Nora. And then what else is there? Meanwhile, Joker is chaos incarnate.
Yeah, no, Freeze's only intent is to get money, finish his studies, heal his wife, you know, but at that point, he's kind of fucked. He'll never be able to fix himself, and in that way, he's just as insane as Joker because he continues doing the same thing, expecting different results. At least the Joker's having fun with it. Freeze is just a giant walking emo popsicle.
Well, Joker's legitimately insane. I think Freeze is just kind of dumb.
Well, no, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing again and again and expecting different results.
No,
Freeze
no, that's not.
Insane.
No, that's not. I hate that definition
oh,
so
much.
If you say Einstein quoted it, you're wrong as well.
No, I don't believe Einstein quoted that because I don't think he had anything to do with the human psyche, did he?
moving on.
Either way, yes, Joker's chaos incarnate, and that's why he's more fun. He's
like
I
think,
makeup.
You know, Mr. Freeze is like, he's an okay antagonist, but I'm trying to think, like, it's kind of the same old shtick. Like, you know, when you're watching, you know, 50s cartoons and, like, the bad guy's just doing the same thing over and over and over and over again. And they're never learning. You know, it's like the story just resets. They've forgotten anything that happens in the past 24 hours and they do it over again. So these people keep running into Batman, and they start hating Batman because Batman's been foiling their same plan for the past, like, 30 years.
Batman has pattern recognition.
Yeah, Batman's, I can learn from my mistakes. What have you been...
Which is funny enough, because a lot of them start out, and he looks at the crime scene, he goes, this looks a lot like X, and then so that's how it starts.
You start out with something like, I want to save my wife, except you're, like, doing criminal things to justify it. And then Batman stops you, and then it slowly evolves into this hatred for Batman, and you've forgotten all about the wife. Doc Mr. Freeze exists at this point just to try to kill Batman, and is saving his wife as second.
Well then!
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking Batman learns from his mistakes. He comes into a bank and everyone's frozen. He goes... He gets on his grid and he looks for the biggest power drain. Okay, well, that looks like an industrial refrigerator. And oh, look, Nora, I'm going to unplug if you don't fucking smarten up again.
I give.
I'm going to pull out my trusty bat heating ray.
Oh, 1980s Batman.
You know, it's just a refurbished hairdryer with a bat symbol on it.
Painted on it, yes. It needs the bat symbol on it or it's not bat something.
You know those stories where you've got this one character, and this one character keeps doing things that, like, grate on your nerves. Like, some of them have made me want to, like, tear books in half with how unlikable and stupid and, like, just asinine they are. But to that same degree, I also have to respect the fact that I'm not supposed to like these characters.
But
and
I
so,
do because I'm weird.
In a way, the fact that I hate them so much makes them a proper antagonist.
Well, it's in Nocturnal by Scott Siegler. In one of the scenes for this young boy who, before he... I can't say much without wrecking it, but he's bullied by kids at school. And reading it, you're like, oh, they're picking on. And then they break his arm with a board in the most descriptive, gut-wrenchingly sick moment of the book. And it's just like, I immediately shut the book and read something else because I hated those characters so much. Because it's just like, oh my God, like, I know it's a fictional character, but what the F are you doing? Yeah. And the thing is this was just... kind of a pre-evolution of the kid's character for later on, things that happen later on. But it's just, it's a case of your antagonists can go very dark places.
And these people are so unlikable, but they're supposed to be. And so, like...
Well, it's like if you've got a...
Some of them are unlikable.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been talking so much about antagonists that we thoroughly enjoy because of the challenge that they present characters. And we haven't really talked about the ones that we hate because...
Well,
you
can enjoy one that you hate as well.
You can, but, like, there are some characters that obstruct the goal of the protagonist so well that you, like, you begin to seethe with anger because they're doing such a good job at stopping the protagonist from completing their objective.
Which is a very good... antagonist. That means they've been written extremely well. So, one of the things that often happens with well-done antagonists is that they become more compelling and more interesting than your main characters. Take, for example, Darth Vader. Darth Vader became insanely popular, more popular than Luke Skywalker, and is a far more recognizable character out of the entire Star Wars franchise than Luke Skywalker himself. So why
probably
does this...
because he's big, black, and wears a cape.
His iconic mask,
the way he spoke, the way that everything else was white and he was black, as Roland said. So why does something like this happen? Why do antagonists become more... or why? How can they, and why does it happen that they become more compelling and interesting than main characters?
Well, like, consider the stark contrast, literally... that Vader is to everyone else. Like, if you consider Luke, as far as Star Wars goes, he's a Jedi, he's the chosen one, he's going to restore balance, he's going to defeat Darth Vader, etc., etc., etc. He's just like everyone else. He's a human. He's not dismembered in any way, and he has superpowers. And
I like that you make that a point.
And then you have Darth Vader, who is, you know, he talks differently, he walks differently, he is a cyborg, he has ungodly powers, like far and above Luke Skywalker.
Fluke.
And he has a far more interesting backstory than Luke's.
Yeah.
Luke, I shot womp rats in my T-30.
Unless you watched the original three movies.
Yeah.
I'm an orphan that everybody loves. You can just call me Annie, too. Get in the theater and die.
But see, the thing is even if you just watched the three, once you know, spoilers, Darth Vader is Luke's father, and Leia's father, as soon as it's revealed that that's the case, he is immediately a far more interesting character than
because
Luke.
Because he's got the...
The most interesting thing about Luke Skywalker is that he almost slept with his sister.
Yep, I love them. Jones. I swear to God, they had a panel when they were screening the first two movies. Like, okay, keep in mind, can we pull this off? Now, remember this episode, you know, where they almost slept together. Can we pull this off? Is it believable? We're going to have, like, a test panel of everyone going, yeah, you could buy it.
No,
and the group
Far as the storyboard for Star Wars, I'm sure that they're just like, yeah, these people are totally going to get hitched, and they'll get married, and...
We forgot.
Oh, but wait a minute. Yeah, okay, let's do that.
Han Solo was also a more interesting character than Luke Skywalker.
Yep.
He probably had him hook up with Leia.
Like, Luke lives one of the most sheltered lives, and so he's a relatively bland character.
But this, with the whole Han Solo thing, and going back to Darth Vader and antagonists, as Ocean so aptly points out in our show notes, everyone falls for the badass.
Yep.
And this goes back into the people...
Because evil is cool and good is dumb.
Those
are his notes, literally.
In a society where we have to follow rules day in and day out, there comes a certain amount of love for the character who doesn't have to follow those rules, necessarily. There's an entire movie, Falling Down, which is about that one entire basis of one guy just saying F you to society and going on a shooting, killing rampage.
It doesn't sound like a good movie.
It's not. It's a terrible movie. But the thing is it was popular at its time because...
It was a movie?
Yeah, a terrible movie.
It's also real life.
No, yeah, that's the thing, is how many people end up snapping and doing whatever.
Are you talking about the one where the guy wants the breakfast meal?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. That scene is iconic.
Yeah.
Because he relates to us as personal people.
It's kind of a dumb movie, but it was so...
Because we're like, it's 11:01, it's sitting right there, why can't you give it to me?
It was so wild.
And he gets to act out what we all want to just give me the freaking meal, because he's got his gun, and his gun is now the most powerful thing there.
It's the equalizer.
Are you saying that everybody wants to be a force-choking badass?
I wouldn't mind doing that.
It's better than Darth Vader.
No. Are you disagreeing with this?
Well,
want to be a force choking badass?
I can't say I've always wanted to go into a fast food restaurant and shoot a hole through the roof. It would be cool.
Can I sign up for all of these things?
Well, the best part is I think he eats it in the restaurant while they're watching. Yeah.
He just, because everyone's runaway screaming, I think, and he's just sitting there eating it. Like, he's back to normal, but he's like, I got my breakfast meal.
But case in point, this is why people tend to fall for the antagonists, is because they end up doing the things that we all want to. And that's where they can become a far more interesting character than your protagonist, is because guess what? They are more interesting to the average person.
But the interesting thing about the main character in Falling Down is that, like, he doesn't want anything unreasonable. And that's almost the entire point of most antagonists. They're going for these really grand things that specifically... block the protagonist from...
I've got a note later on, but it was something that Jan brought up last night. You're Aladdin.
Oh, with Jafar? How he's actually not that much of a bad guy? It's Iago who started the whole thing, and then when he got... Well, basically, you look at it. Jafar is the right-hand man to an idiot. He sees this idiot running the kingdom and playing with toys when he could be doing much more for the people, much more for, you know, the city as a whole. But he's stuck with this moron that he has to kind of, you know, hey, we can, you know, do stuff with all this unlimited power. And then, basically, he just wants to marry Jasmine, wants to be Sultan. It's all he wants things to go good. It's Iago that gives him the idea to bump him off. So we take the little woman and then we take Papa-in-law and the little woman and throw them off a cliff.
I think Jafar was still evil in the first place. It's just he nudged him like, we can make this a reality.
Yeah,
give in to your dark side.
Yeah, but see, Jafar was contained until Iago pushed it. And then he got the lamp and went a little batshit. But he didn't have that grandiose plans. He just wanted to do better by the people. He wanted to rule better than the Sultan. And then the bumbling idiot with his toys.
Yeah, that's what every evil villain is like. I just want to make everything better.
If I walk
like Scar, let's invite the hyenas in. They won't have totally adding more predators.
Diversity.
Won't make a difference.
But like, if I invite somebody to go murder somebody else, and they say yes, that doesn't make them...
that doesn't make them a good person, I'm the evil one.
That does not make them not a bad person. Their decision to follow through on these actions still makes them a terrible person. They're just not, like, the mastermind or the instigator.
Isn't it bad when you think that Iago was the mastermind?
Well, that's why I meant specified instigator. He's not a mastermind. He's kind of a murderous idiot.
He needs my t-shirt, the one that says the enabler.
And that's why in the second and third movies in the show, he becomes the helpful, stupid parrot.
Yeah,
I didn't get that. I mean, he turned in from the let's kill everybody and get what you want to the, oh, hey, yeah, sure. I'll get the lamp for you and help you out.
One of those flip-floppy characters that goes with the person with the most power.
It's like now, they're just feeding him cookies.
Because he was played by Gilbert Gottfried. Come on.
Yeah. Now, another reason why your antagonist might be more liked than your protagonist is he could just be cooler.
Iago's not cool.
No, not Iago.
I don't think Iago was the antagonist of that movie.
No, Jafar definitely.
He was the instigator.
Jafar was cool.
Jafar was awesome.
Iago's just the Chekhov's gun.
Iago is the Igor to Dr. Frankenstein.
Yeah, but he's like, we could kill these people. And Jafar's like, yes, here's the plan.
But in the case of just being cooler, it can be anything as looks, like my most hated character in all the world, Boba Fett.
That just goes back to everyone loves the badass. What makes them cool?
Well,
because they're wearing
usually
black.
But the thing
because
badass.
Black
no,
is
no,
badass
but,
and cool.
But the thing is,
I got the leather jacket.
The
I'm
only,
part of the skulls with
the,
my
no, no, no,
fold-out
the,
knife,
the
or is
only,
it a fold-out coat?
The only reason Boba Fett is popular is because he looks cool.
Yeah.
And no point does Boba Fett 1
no, no,
or
no.
2 do
Boba
anything
Boba Fett
cool.
is cool.
No, he's not.
Because he's a friggin' bounty hunter.
Big
he's
Kino,
a badass.
Bounty
he's
there.
A bounty
Kino
hunter.
A bounty
that,
hunter.
Bounty hunters already give you a one level up too bad ass.
He can't.
Because you're too cool to be a police officer.
I've got a bit of a parallel.
You're too cool to be in the military. You're a lone wolf. You run by your own code. You bring in people. You do whatever you want. The money is yours at the end of the day. But you play by your own rules.
His dad, who is essentially him, died, got his head chopped off, and then he proceeded to not capture Han Solo. Someone else did it for him.
He didn't capture Han Solo.
If you think about it, like... You
no,
know,
he told them that, hey, Vader, Thrawn Bespin, quickly, come do all my work
Boba
for
Fett's
me.
Boba Fett's kind of a badass in the same way, and a bounty hunter as, like, Cowboy Bebop, where they never actually do anything. They do a lot of inconsequential stuff that has a point,
I mean,
but ultimately ends up not getting them anywhere.
Okay.
What's the name of the bounty hunter that tries to get Han Solo in the very first, and he gets shot? He was a bounty hunter. Yeah, it was Greedo. Greedo was a bounty hunter, and he wasn't freaking cool. He was a tool.
Because he got killed.
Exactly. So being a bounty hunter is deep.
No, but give him one level up, because he was already...
Okay, so we have to give him a jetpack and a leather jacket, and then suddenly...
No, because he was already face-to-face with Han Solo, and we were already like, oh, Han Solo's a big man. This guy's talking up to another big man.
It's totally the suit.
And how many crimes are solved?
It is totally the suit.
Okay. How many crimes are solved in a day? So many, but how many do we actually hear about? Only the interesting ones. So we don't know how many criminals they've taken in Cowboy Bebop or Boba Fett, because it's not that interesting.
Criminals. He is a criminal.
It's totally
the same.
He's
a bounty hunter.
Like,
same thing.
It's kind of for the same reason that everyone loves Ewoks is because they're small, cute, and fuzzy.
Do people actually like Ewoks?
I liked Ewoks.
Pretty sure.
I'm not so sure.
I don't know.
I think it's because the Ewok movie ruined it for everyone.
Yes. And then the TV series didn't help either.
Chub wub. Chub wub.
This turned into quite the discussion on Boba Fett, but... I think that, you know, when it comes to antagonists, it's so easy to know what's going to happen to the protagonist in most stories. The protagonist is going to win. And so that kind of makes it boring for the reader. And so you have these antagonists who are the ones that truly have the struggle. The people that are trying so hard to accomplish something but never succeed.
Actually, I know a movie where the protagonist wins.
I know a lot of those too.
Dagon! You
said the protagonist wins.
No, the antagonist. Sorry.
Yes, I'm just going to let you know.
The antagonist wins on that one. Dagon! You have the cultists and you have the poor guy who's been drawn back to the island and it's all a trap and they're going to kill him because they kill everybody that comes on the island. They skin them and they wear their faces because they're so mutated that they can't go out in public society anymore. And then they find out at the end that this guy has the right blood to summon Dagon from the depths, so he ends up joining with the High Priestess and the Innsmouth wins.
There's
the
also Dagon, House in the Woods.
There's lots so of movies good. where the protag doesn't win.
But
Cabin in the Woods.
But the protagonist, that was funny. But yeah, the protagonist is also, okay, the antagonist is basically the cult of Dagon. The protagonist is this poor schnup who is getting lured back to the island. He, usually if the antagonist wins, the protagonist dies, right? Or at least falls through or something bad happens to them. In this one, the antagonist joins the protagonist joins the antagonists and they live happily ever after.
Which is very close to the Shadow Over Innsmouth. And anti-heroes. Because that one way, especially in the 80s, to make a protagonist more interesting is to make them almost villains. So they became these anti-heroes where they don't have the same morals. They, you know, can have this more power and they're not afraid, you know, not afraid to abuse it. And they're not afraid to abuse, quote-unquote, normal people, so on and so forth. And thus fulfill the insertion fantasy that most people have when they want to read without having a person go and fall in love with the antagonist. The problem with an anti-hero is if you already have a hero who's this way, you have to have an antagonist who's that much more above and beyond where your anti-hero is.
Well, just what makes them more interesting protagonists? Because they don't follow a lot of the same conventions.
Well, and that's where the threat with the whole them becoming your antagonist becoming more popular than your protagonist is this is how some people have chosen to solve it, by making anti-heroes. And in creating anti-heroes, you are essentially just making kind of hero protagonist antagonists. If that makes any sense? But it's just, it's a way of making them interesting. So how do you make your protagonist more interesting than your antagonist?
Give them more relatable problems, I suppose. But that's, I'm not sure that's always true either, because you have the anti-hero, which shouldn't really be relatable except for the fact that they do the things that everybody wishes they could, but I don't know if there's anything relatable about, say, like blowing up a building in the process of a high-speed chase.
What aspects of antagonists that are cool and that everyone loves antagonists can you apply as well to the protagonist?
Their struggle.
The interesting... Well, their interesting backstory. As much as we've ragged on it before, Batman's losing his parent. Now, albeit losing your parents is not a story make, but the thing for a character like Batman, especially as a vigilante, he is ultimately more interesting because he has a tragedy that is pulling him and driving him to do what he does, something that a lot of antagonists have. In the case, to use our whipping horse for this episode, Luke Skywalker as a protagonist isn't that interesting because he doesn't have any kind of background that's interesting to engage the viewer. And you can have that in writing where your protagonists aren't, you know, they either have this uninteresting backstory that you really don't care about, or they can have something where it draws you in, makes you actually care about them like you would your antagonist.
What about his aunt and uncle dying?
I forgot about that.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think it's because you didn't really get to know them.
No, you didn't.
It's like Uncle Ben.
Did you get to know Uncle Ben?
You didn't get to know Batman's parents either.
That's true.
Oh, frick.
Then you do get flashbacks.
Shit.
Like Harry Potter, a lot of people find Harry is the most boring character in.
And he is.
And there's a theory that this happens because you're in the protagonist's head. You're basically following the protagonist around. So you're seeing everything through their eyes, what they perceive. So everything they see is going to be more interesting than themselves. In your own reality, you are not the most exciting thing unless you're incredibly self-centered. So everything you do, everyone you interact, is always going to be more interesting than yourself.
Though if you think about the death of Batman's parents and the death of Uncle Ben, is that, if I recall correctly with Batman, that both of their deaths, or all of their deaths, are the main character's fault. You have Spider-Man, who's like, I'm not going to stop this robber. Oh, look, Uncle Ben. And then the kid, who's like, I don't feel well. I'm going to go out and his parents die, or whatever. I'm basing this off the movie. So I don't know
if the comics
are any different. Well, Luke dicks off to...
Luke wasn't at the farm.
Yeah, he dicks off.
Like, he's not there, but it's not his fault that his family died. It's just kind of inconsequential.
See, I'd put the parents dying more as something a trait to the hero's journey, where they need something to move them on. I don't know if that makes them more interesting or not.
It depends on how you use it. Which, again, that's why it doesn't make your story. There's more to it that you can, like, especially, what was it? Oh, crap. Oh, yeah, there was, I was watching, it was, I think, Batman Brave and the Bold, where they did the parents' death scene for Batman, except the way that they did it was, he was an egotistical little brat, and they're like, oh, surprise, we got you tickets to go see this or whatever, and he's like, no, I wanted a swashbuckler, and he throws a huge tantrum, and then they go to a movie because they're like, hey, well, we can't get you this action figure that you want, so we'll go see a movie about a swashbuckler, Zorro, to make you feel better, and he sulks through the entire thing, and he's pissy through the entire thing, and then they leave, and they're trying to cheer him up because he's still being a little a-hole boy, and then his parents get killed. And then it's just like, oh my god, like, imagine if that was your last moments with your parents. You would feel, especially as a kid, you would feel horrible. And immediately that is a far better story than they walked into an alley after a wonderful evening at seeing whatever, parents got mugged, killed.
Or like, I came back from a year-long vacation to find out my parents are dead.
Yeah.
If you don't know who they are as characters.
Yeah. Where it's like, if you immediately make it that much more tragic to the character, and which makes it interesting. Which is something that you usually see in antagonists, but not so much in protagonists. Because usually antagonists are out for revenge, they're out for equalization, they're out for something.
The antagonist is already set outside the norm, which makes them special, quote unquote, which already brings our eye to interest to them. The protagonist, on the other hand, is generally doing something like following the rules, or is just that ordinary guy. Like, you think of some of the cooler protagonists, like everyone loved Firefly,
mm-hmm.
Captain Reynolds, you know, but he's also going about the norm. He's going against the norm. He's making his own rules. He's breaking out and he's being himself.
Yeah.
You know, go back to Luke. What's the most interesting thing that Luke did? You know, he broke away with the norm because he
got
ran
his hand
away.
Cut off.
Well,
because he should have stayed and trained, and he didn't. He ran off.
The most interesting, the only time that Luke becomes a truly interesting character is the third movie, when he's turning evil because he is starting to do things like force choking pig guards. And that, where he's going against the norm, as you said. Until that point, he's really not doing anything that brings him out as an interesting character. Because he is just going by the norm. He's not doing anything interesting, so on and so forth.
So, character development?
See, that's the thing, is how do you prevent your antagonist from, beyond making them completely unlikable, which is...
But that doesn't mean they're not interesting.
Yeah.
Like, I have the same issue. My antagonists are always cooler.
I guess
I'm always focusing on the conflict that they're going to encounter.
How do you make a protagonist more interesting without making him an anti-hero?
It's next week on Protagonist.
See, Confessions of a D-List Supervillain. I really enjoyed the protagonist in that. The only thing was, is as the protagonist was a D-list supervillain, so he was already going against the norm. Oddly enough, he was going against the quote-unquote good guys, one of which, the Iron Man of their universe, was actually an a-hole, and as the main antagonist became, wasn't more interesting than the protagonist, because the protagonist had so much relatability to the reader, and the uphill struggle against such a powerful, well-loved, rich guy who stole your girlfriend immediately made you sympathize. And like, maybe that's it. Sympathy.
Sympathy is definitely a key.
With the protagonist more than the antagonist. Because you ended up hating the antagonist for, you know, because once everything got sorted out and you're like, okay, he got everything he wanted. I'm happy. No, it's taken away by the antagonist. And then you're just like, I effing am so pissed off at this antagonist. Because you're already sympathizing with this protagonist.
Some of the more interesting stories that I've seen coming out recently are things like you have the protagonist, you know, like it's like the run of superhero stories showing the superheroes leading relatively normal and mundane lives, but with superpowers. You know, it's going through issues that we experience as people, you know, a little less exaggerated than something like Falling Down, where you encounter the breakfast menu 5 minutes after it's closed. Like, people with real normal issues that are going up against, you know, people that are just slightly bigger assholes than they are.
See, I think that... And I think you kind of touched on an interesting point where it's if you make the villain someone that you actually start to hate by having a protagonist that you know that can take them down to begin cheering for them.
True.
You mm-hmm. put your back behind them. You become interested in them because now they are the one that's going to solve your problem.
Which because, is part of what brings it back to your antagonist being a like legitimately hateable character.
You don't always have to do that, but it's an option.
Right? It doesn't have to, but yeah, it's...
At the same time, like...
It's something that makes you not like this
character. When you have a cool antagonist, you like having him around because you're like, oh, what sort of mischief is he going to get into this time? What cool trick is he going to pull this time, you know? And then, like, I've read books in that where it's like, oh, yeah, this guy's really cool. And then he does something horrific, and you're like, I don't like this guy anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get rid of him. Well, I want him gone now.
And there's been stories that I've written where the protagonist for the story is meant to be the person you don't like. And yeah, much the same way where it's like he does certain things and then he'll say something or his say spoken an opinion and he ends up becoming, you immediately go, I don't want to see you succeed. But you feel obligated because he's the protagonist until he reaches a point where you're like, he's going to get his comeuppance. And at that point, you are waiting for it to happen. And it's those kind of protagonists where you want them to fail. You want them to die. Mostly because they're jerks.
Hmm. There's got to be other solutions other than make your bad guy a jerk, though.
And making you sympathize. Well, I like the sympathize, or making your protagonist
you should have a level of sympathy for your main character. If you can't sympathize with them, you're not going to be interested.
I think the problem is, as a writer, when you end up... Your first warning sign should be if you start paying more attention to your antagonist and you end up liking your own antagonist more than your protagonist. Because if you've already in that set as the writer, your readers are going to pick up on that.
But part of being a good writer is making all of your characters compelling, you know, for different reasons.
True. But you're also trying to get them to follow the story of your protagonist.
Well, sometimes it just comes to the way you're developing a story. Like, sometimes you go, I really like this character, let's see where it goes. And other times you're like, I really like this conflict, I want this to happen. And that's going to have a heavy impact on what the cool, quote-unquote, factor of your story will be. Because what your emphasis on it is.
I think ultimately going against the grain is just such a level of like fantasy fulfillment that we all have that it makes these characters more compelling and interesting than the protagonists.
That's why we like, you know, vigilantes.
Mm-hmm. And like, of the three stories that I'm writing now, I have a feeling that the antagonist is going to be the most interesting character. Because he's the one that knows, you know, how to use his abilities the best. He's the one that actually has a purpose to use them. And he's evil. He just wants to control everything, and so...
Would character conflict be a good way of improving your protagonist over your antagonist?
I would hope so.
No, so would I. I would think that your antagonist is not having character conflicts.
I lead character conflict back to character development.
Mm-hmm.
By developing your main character, we're investing time in them, we're making him interesting or her interesting.
I think trying to make the reader empathize and sympathize with your protagonist is likely going to be one of the
primary
most things. Surefire ways to make your protagonist more interesting.
That's, if you go back to like, if I think about things I've written, if there was things where it's like, I want this to happen in the story, generally the antagonist is going to be more interesting. Mm-hmm. For our weird Western,
mm-hmm.
I started with two characters that I just want to see what they can do.
Yeah.
And now they're the most interesting characters in my story. Because that's the vantage point.
Banjo shotgun, though.
What?
Banjo shotgun.
Banjo shotgun. People can read the banjo shotgun next month. You don't know. You never read the story.
Crack.
No. You were supposed to send it to me. Oh, no. That's your pulp story?
That's my pulp story. Except he just ruined it for you.
Yeah. Don't worry, happens quickly enough.
Sorry, I was...
that was the most interesting part of the story. Everyone comments on that.
Well, it's like Jericho Tanner. Jericho Tanner is the most interesting character in that entire story. Why? Because the primary antagonist of the cult and the bear...
Took me a minute, I'm like, who's the antagonist? No, right,
I just sat here and was trying to think, who is the antagonist of that story? Right, the cult and the bear.
Yeah.
Who didn't really do anything except shoot places up.
Giant crystal mitts. Or yeah,
funny.
The gloves of the mad gorilla god something or
check
other.
Check this out in pulp next month.
Yeah.
The banjo shotgun actually reminds me that sometimes you're just not going to know what makes your characters so compelling. Some of the like most compelling, interesting, and deepest characters that I've seen were the ones that didn't talk.
Oh, yeah.
Like, in a sea of people that do talk, you've got this one character who is silent, and, you know, not for any specific reason, but you ultimately have to find a different way to express them.
Now they're the dark, mysterious figure trope.
I get where you're going. But it doesn't have to be that trope either.
Then what trope is it? Why aren't they speaking? I'm compelled to know why.
Okay,
what are they holding back? Are they plotting something? Are they thinking? Or are they just mute?
Okay, yeah. The one character that I'm thinking of, like, The Nut Job, terrible movie. But two of the most interesting characters did not say a word. You had a mouse that was mute, for as far as I knew. And then you had, like, this... giant red angry bird,
mm-hmm.
who just didn't talk. He was just literally like a weight with wings.
But did they then have to express themselves in different ways?
They express themselves through actions, but
exactly.
They didn't.
They become more interesting because they have to overemphasize what they're trying to say.
It wasn't.
And so you're drawn in more.
It wasn't even like a game of charades. It was these characters doing things just to express what they were thinking, as opposed to trying to motion to what they're trying to convey. Like, the bird, all it does is get in the way and, like, beat the shit out of stuff. And all the mouse does is look sad or happy. And pretty much through the entire movie.
That said, they're not protagonists.
No.
Yeah, now we're just talking about how to make interesting characters.
Damn it. Thought I had that.
Point, match, voice.
Golf clap. Yeah.
But I mean, you can ultimately use techniques like those to make an interesting protagonist as well if you wanted.
Well, yeah, at the same time, just about anything that will make an interesting character, I would hopefully make your protagonist.
You ultimately give them a disability that makes their struggle more real and more interesting.
And
which goes back to the sympathy.
Yeah, and I mean, it can be as much as the opening line to your story. Your hook could be the thing that ends up catching your character, the person's eye for the love of that character. Jericho Tanner, that's the first thing you learn about him. He can't die.
Mm-hmm. And he's got guns.
You could give a character a prosthetic leg and it falls off, and then he falls down, and then he can't get to his prosthetic leg.
Well, there's one story by...
I'm baby legs. This is normal legs.
I think it's Stackpool, where it's like the opening to the book was a guy watching his own funeral. Because it was staged, but literally the opening line is him watching his funeral and just making a comment about it. Immediately, he is the most interesting character in that novel because you want to know what the hell happened. It doesn't matter whatever antagonist comes on or how cool he is, that opening hook line automatically has your attention for that character. I mean, there's a number of tricks you can do. There is a book out there called, what is it? Bitches, Bullies, Bitches, and Badasses, which is all about writing basically anti-heroes and antagonists and basically what makes protagonists engaging. And they go through a little bit overboard, but they do have some excellent points as to what makes certain characters, especially those characters that bend the rules, that much more interesting, and how to write really good antagonists and really good protagonists who have that anti-hero twist to them. I do recommend it for anyone who is struggling with this. I personally found it a bit too wordy, and she ends up repeating herself a lot, but all in all, it was still a good read. I know Sparf picked it up. Anything else?
I think no? We touched on the main part, is if you want your protagonist to be interesting, you should actually be interested in your protagonist.
Did you say protagonist twice?
Yes.
Yes. No, that makes sense. Never mind. Okay. I was like, wait a minute. And your antagonist should also be interesting and ultimately challenging to your protagonist, so you have an interesting conflict in your story. Because if you don't have an interesting conflict between a protagonist and an antagonist, no one's going to give a rat's ass about your story.
Mm-hmm. If you don't give a rat's ass about something, your readers won't either.
Mm-hmm.
Great job, everyone. Anything else to add?
We'll be at RF.
I meant about protagonists and antagonists.
We'll be at RF.
There will be antagonists and protagonists at RF.
Actually,
in the RF anthology.
Which we're in.
Woo.
Woo. Who was the antagonist in my RF story?
I don't know. Actually, I haven't read your RF story.
Actually, I think it's society. He, my character. No, in my story.
No, I just love the way. Society is my antagonist.
Well, no. In
bringing
this...
me down with their social norms.
But that's the thing is because it's cyberpunk, right? Well, it's a dystopian universe, and generally, a lot of the themes within a cyberpunk universe is people against the status quo.
I'm more like an anti-hero.
So you're a hero?
No, I'm anti-hero.
He's a double.
I take down anti-heroes for fun.
That's called antagonist and protagonist. They take them down.
Is my laptop falling apart?
Actually, more likely protagonists are going to take down anti-heroes, but...
I probably shouldn't be moving. Anyway, my laptop's falling apart. K stopped working.
I need a new one.
So yes, we'll be at RF.
We'll be at RF. Doing many a panel. But specifically, we'll be doing a Fangs and Fonts panel on networking. What was the full title of it?
Networking and Social Media with Writing. Yeah. A lot of people keep asking us to do talking like, when I'm at a con, how can I approach people? How do you guys find beta readers? So how do you know all of these writers? So what better place to do it than at a location where there will be lots of writers? So if you're at the con, come listen to us, join in on the conversation. If you can't make the con, don't worry, we'll be posting it online as well. It's Friday night is our panel.
Late in the evening, 10? Yeah.
No, I want to say 8 because I think 10 is MC and the Coyotes are at 7, which everyone should go to.
Yeah.
and then sneak out at 8 to go to ours.
Go to all the writing panels. Seriously.
Except the ones that you can't because they're simultaneously at the same time.
Yeah, that's true. Then get a time turner.
In addition to that, we'll all be doing separate panels as well, in addition to our Fangs and Fawns panel.
How many panels are there that doesn't have one of us on it?
Very few.
That's actually a I'm good not point. Sure which ones I'm actually supposed to be on yet.
Well, the update on the last schedule seems to be standing and fairly accurate.
So if we're to believe the schedule, you can find me at Writing Realistic Dialogue.
Just check out the schedule. Actually during, just check out the schedule.
Yeah, because we're not listing our nine. During the Fangs and Fawns podcast.
You can search the schedule by our names too, so that'll save you some scanning time.
Hopefully, if it's working.
It's working fairly well.
Sweet.
Otherwise, yeah, if you want, pick up the RF Anthology if you're at the con. If not, you can order it from Fur Planet. Both Voice and myself are in it, as well as some other great authors. Kyle Gold's there, you know, if you like him. I hear he's pretty big.
It's a large anthology.
Yeah, there's 11 stories in it, and all the proceeds go to charity. So,
and you should definitely check out...
It's only $10.
Fur Planet's going to be there. You should buy books that were in... And I think they also...
Rabbit Valley will not be there, but I think...
They won't be there, but Fur Planet
you'll be able to find their books, I'm sure. I'd be surprised.
Yeah.
And Sofa Wolf is there.
Yeah. Well, I would hope if Kyle Gold's going to be there, Sofa Wolf would be there.
Yep. So if you want to contact us, feel free to check us out at pretty much anywhere at Fangs and Fonts.
Fangsandfonts.com for the website.
Our email is...
podcast@fangsandfonts. We're also on Twitter and Facebook and all the other websites. Go find us. Send us emails. Send us comments. We'd love to hear from you guys.
If there's anything you want us to talk about, feel free to let us know. If there's anyone you want us to talk to, let us know.
Also, some people have been asking about the RSS feed to subscribe outside of iTunes. I'll be finding that for the Twitter feed somewhat soon.
Awesome. All right. Have a good night, guys.
Good night.
Interesting that, you know, you introduce something like an anti-hero who is, you know, effectively the protagonist, and it suddenly makes it more interesting not to follow the law, you know, not to...
Like a bounty hunter?
When there's a movie about Boba Fett, then he can be a part of this conversation.
You want me to pull out movies about bounty hunters? I can find you some.
No, but Boba Fett specifically. There's a reason why they put him into the Clone Wars TV series as a little boy. And actually,
because then Jango or whatever that stupid guy's name was the cool
Jango. No. Jango was dead. It's basically Boba Fett meeting all the other bounty hunters that somehow are in episode 4, 5, 3.
Was there even one of the book series was on the bounty hunters?
There's a lot of, yeah, there's a book anthology. I wonder why. There's an anthology.
Bounty hunters are cool.